This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Dr. John Nigel, who is the 2015 Nimitz Lecturer on the Berkeley campus. A soldier, scholar, and educator, he is the 9th headmaster of the Haverford School. Awarded 2 Bronze Stars for service in Iraq, Dr. Nagel retired from the Army as a lieutenant colonel. He is the author of Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war and theory and practice, and Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, Counterinsurgency Lessons from Malaya and Vietnam. He was on the writing team that produced the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual. Dr. Nagel was a Rhodes Scholar and most recently the inaugural Minerva Research Professor at the U.S. Naval Academy. Dr. Nagel was previously the president of the Center for a New American Security in Washington, D.C. John, welcome to our program.
It's delightful to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
Right here. Born at Mare Island Power Station, nuclear station in Vallejo, California. My dad was a submariner teaching electrical engineering, nuclear power, right down the street.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
My father was a very good electrical engineer. There were right answers to every question. My mom, a registered nurse, mother of 6, sainted already, and she's not dead yet. Mom understood people and empathy and human emotions, which were all foreign territory, a foreign country to my dad. And I like to think I got dad's analytics and mom's empathy.
And was it inevitable that you would look toward a military career, or did that come later?
No, it came later. I've got a 13-year-old son at home, and I was not a lot older than he is when I started asking my dad where I should think about going to college. He was first-generation college. He'd gone to Marquette on a Naval ROTC scholarship. And he was enormously impressed by the Naval Academy graduates he met while serving in the Navy, and so recommended Annapolis to me. And when you apply to one of the service academies, they encourage you to apply to all of them, very similar kids at each of the schools. And I was lucky enough to get into the Coast Guard Academy, into West Point, and into Annapolis. And my dad took me on a tour of those schools my junior year in high school. And when I got to West Point, I immediately fell in love with the place. I just felt home. And there are a few places in the world that I love more than the United States Military Academy at West Point. It was a great choice for me.
What was most gratifying about your education at West Point? What stands out as to what they got right in terms of educating you as a soldier?
So West Point, a remarkable institution, and I was enormously fortunate. I came to West Point intending to be an electrical engineer like my father. But I fell under the sway of a man named Dan Kaufman. Dan was a Vietnam veteran, armored cavalryman in Vietnam, wounded. West Point graduate himself, class of 1968, so exactly 20 years older than I was. And Dan was the chair of the International Relations Program at West Point. And he very quickly convinced me that I needed to drop my electrical engineering ambitions and become a political scientist. And the department he introduced me to, the Department of Social Sciences at West Point, is the stuff of legend, and I was taught by giants, among them then Captain David Petraeus. And so the officers, the mentors who didn't just educate me in politics and political science and military strategy and the history of war, but also really inspired me to see my calling as service to America. And gave me a love, inspired in me or nurtured in me a love of learning. My mom, I think, gave me some of that as well. But it really flowered under the tutelage of these people. And ultimately, West Point taught me how to answer questions. That was an incomplete education, but it was a very, very good foundation.
Mm-hmm. And this inspiration that came from the social Sciences Department at West Point led you to seek a Rhodes Scholarship, in which you acquired and then went to Oxford to do an advanced degree.
That's all true. I should give some credit, of course, to the Jesuits who had me before West Point and who taught me to be to aspire to be a man for others, and also gave me some analytics and some rigor. And I'm thinking of my Father Hindelang, my Latin teacher. I won the Latin prize at prep. I was enormously proud of that. And so the Jesuits and West Point, Dan Kaufman in the Soch Department, and then now for something entirely different, Oxford University, a very unstructured program. And so if West Point taught me how to find the answers to questions, Oxford taught me to spend real time thinking about what questions were worth asking. And at Oxford, I fell under the sway of another Vietnam veteran, a remarkable man named Bob O'Neill, who was the Chichley Professor of the History of War at All Souls College, Oxford, which I think remains the coolest job title on the planet.
So you went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, got an MA, but then you went into service in the first Iraq War.
So almost immediately. Yeah. So I left Oxford, I think, in June of 1990, and was on orders to the 1st Cavalry Division at Fort Hood, Texas, to become a tank platoon leader, and was supposed to arrive there in September, I believe. I was getting some refresher training on tanks first, falling back into the hands of the Army, which thought I might have lost my Army edge a little bit while drinking warm beer at Oxford. And in the interim, while that was all happening, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August of 1990.
So as a soldier now, you are fighting a war which is very much a conventional war. And so you have that experience under your belt. Talk briefly about that.
Very much the war that the Army wanted to fight, that the Army had been planning and preparing to fight for literally generations. So it was a conventional tank-on-tank clash in a desert, almost exclusively devoid of civilians. Politics stopped. The war started, and then politics picked up again after the war was over. We shot the tanks that didn't look like ours. It was physically difficult, and there was math and science involved in getting the artillery to strike at the right time and in the right place, and so that the airplanes could fly in so that they could do their business and then the tanks could do their business. So it was not easy by any means, but it was pure Army, pure war of the kind that Napoleon would have understood and approved of.
Your story is one of a remarkable balancing of scholarship and soldiering. And before we talk about your coming back to Oxford and the book that you wrote, let's talk briefly about that. What are the skills and temperament involved in balancing these two different modalities of existence, thinking, scholarship on the one hand, and being a soldier and fighting wars on the other?
And so I would describe myself as, for a soldier, I think I was a very good scholar, and for a scholar, I'm a pretty good soldier. I hope I get the balance about right. I wouldn't say that I was exceptionally good at either, but the combination is I think, rare and somewhat interesting. I'm fortunate, I guess, to be reasonably robust, to enjoy sports, and being a soldier is an outdoor sport, and it involves building teams of people who share a common vision and who make up for each other's weaknesses and enhance each other's strengths and work together to reach a common goal. And I enjoy all those things. I like building teams. I like inspiring people. I believe in what the Army does. And so I think I was able to do that reasonably well. My scholarship is of a very practical nature, and I think the electrical engineer, the analytics that I got from my father never really went away. And so when you read my doctoral dissertation, for instance, which I would guess we're about to talk about, you can see a very cause and effect, almost mechanical understanding of how societies form, governments do their business, wars are conducted. And so I think that the balance, the combination of the two different skill sets and the two different perspectives is probably reasonably rare.
Mm-hmm. So you go back to Oxford to work under Professor O'Neill again. And,
as if he hadn't suffered enough.
That's right. And you then chose in your dissertation to focus on insurgency and talk a little about the picking of that topic and the analysis you used.
So I actually have to go back in time to do that, I'm afraid. So almost exactly a year after Desert Storm, my first war, a great little war, where we dismantled the Iraqi army. We turned it from the fourth largest in the world to the second largest in Iraq in a period of 100 hours. And I reflected on that experience in the aftermath of that war, I had the opportunity to almost exactly a year later conduct a pretend war, a training exercise at the Army's National Training Center in Fort Irwin, California. And we were preparing for another tank battle just like the one we'd fought in Desert Storm, but we never got to fight that fight. Because during the night, a band of guerrillas, insurgents, came out of the mountains and killed every one of our tanks with light anti-tank weapons and with artillery fire, with mortar fire. And so I reflected on these two combat experiences, one of them real combat, the other simulated combat, in which the outcomes had been completely different. And I recognized that we were really, really good at destroying other enemy tank armies, but almost completely useless when confronted by insurgents, terrorists, guerrillas, who fought us in ways we didn't expect. And so when the Army gave me the chance to go back to Oxford to get my PhD, to make that sacrifice for our great nation, I decided to look not at the kind of war we were really, really good at, tank-on-tank warfare, but the kind of war that we were bad at. Because I was convinced that our enemies would not walk into our strengths. I thought that they would attack us at our weakest point. And the good news is I was right, and the bad news is I was right.
And so you chose as your dissertation topic this question of counterinsurgency, comparing the British experience in Malay, which later became Malaysia, and the American experience in Vietnam. And I'm intrigued by the social science model you used to explore this material. So talk briefly about that. In other words, you came to look at the U.S. Army as a learning organization and wound up not giving it good grades in comparison with the British. No. Talk a little about that model and then what you saw.
So the interesting thing to me about the Malayan emergency and the Vietnam War, they'd been compared before, but in both cases, an army that was organized, designed, trained, and equipped to fight another army, a mirror image force, found itself confronting a guerrilla, an insurgent, an enemy which it couldn't find often, and to fight a kind of war for which it was completely unprepared by temperament, by equipment, by training, by organization. And so the challenge of adapting an organization literally under fire to do something it hadn't been designed to do struck me as a really interesting leadership and organizational challenge. And as I tried to find a new lens with which to examine these two cases, which had been compared before, I came upon organizational learning theory, which looks at how organizations learn and adapt to changes in their environment. And I found it to be a fascinating perspective from which to view two very dissimilar in many ways wars, but wars that presented the British Army in Malaya and the American Army in Vietnam with similar challenges. They really had to remake themselves while in combat. And I thought the British Army was far more successful at doing that in Malaya than was the American Army in Vietnam.
And before we talk about this case study of counterinsurgency, which is the core of the book, what can we talk a little about the Army and its failings as a learning organization? What variables do you identify? Because it's tough love as you criticize the Army, but let's understand that.
Mm-hmm. So the critical independent variable I decided that explained the difference in outcomes, that one army was able to learn and adapt in time and the other was not, was the organizational culture of the two institutions. And I think that affects whether organizations are able to learn, how effectively, how quickly they're able to learn. And the idea is that every organization has a culture that is a persistent, patterned way of thinking about the central problems that the organization is designed to confront, to deal with. And the British Army has a very long colonial past, doesn't have lots of material resources, has to make do with what it has available to it, and has, as a result, I think, a greater Fingerspitzgefühl for societies and cultures. And I think the long history of the British Empire has a lot to do with that. I think the regimental tradition of the British Army, the smaller army in which everyone knows each other and in which class plays a real role among British officers, which in some ways allows senior officers to encourage innovation in those junior to them. It doesn't matter that they're smarter necessarily. The class structure and the rank structure remains. The American Army, very, very different. Certainly the American Army of the 1950s and the 1960s, flush with victory in the Second World War, but it had all the advantages and disadvantages of American culture, an excess of reliance upon technology and materials. The U.S. Army, famous for almost unlimited firepower available to it, artillery shells as far as the eye could see, the great American industrial engine providing every material element of war that the American Army could possibly want. But very little of the international relations experience that the British Army had, an unwillingness to engage in politics, and because of the absence of the regimental system, because of the absence of class structure in American society, a much more rigid hierarchy among officers, all of which I thought contributed to a failure to innovate, and in particular to innovate in the ways required to win a very, very political tribal war like the one we fought in Vietnam.
In your newer book, which called Knife Fights, a memoir of a modern war in theory and practice, you mention another element which I thought was interesting, which now speaking more generally about the U.S. Army, you say that because we rarely face an adversary, we get hooked in a way which becomes stagnant. And so when the war comes, we're ready to do the old way.
So businesses have the organizational learning theory drawn largely from business literature and business thinking. And organizations like businesses compete every day for real. And they can tell literally at the end of every day how they're doing in relation to their competitors. Dell Computer knows every day whether it's outselling or not outselling Apple, and it's not. Apple's winning, right? And they know, and that gives additional incentives to Dell Computer to do things differently, to innovate literally every day. Armies do what they do on a big scale, perhaps once a generation. And so they don't have the competitive pressures. They don't have the immediate feedback that businesses do. To try to mitigate that problem, armies set up training exercises. They practice in a simulated environment, but they write their own rules and they devise their own enemy. And so in the decade after Desert Storm, after my first war, I engaged repeatedly in training exercises in which we fought mirror image armies, tank armies with artillery and air power, and we fought simulated World War II battles, simulated Desert Storm battles over and over again, despite the fact that no one in the world had those kind of resources or in their right mind would ever choose to fight us that way. And so in business, you won't get it that far wrong or you'll go out of business. In the Army, writes its own tests and can go very, very, very far wrong. And that's what happened to the American Army in the decade after Desert Storm.
So your dissertation has an interesting title, and you should tell us where that title comes from, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, Counterinsurgency Lessons from Malaya and Vietnam. Where does the title come from? And then tell us about the mechanisms by which the Army forgot how to fight insurgency.
Mm-hmm. So the title comes from an observation from T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, who led a band of Arab guerrillas during the First World War, and he actually felt sorry for the enemy he was fighting against. He said, for them, we're a vapor. We rise up out of the sand, congeal, strike, and dissolve back into the sand. They're like a blind boxer. They could kill us if they could only find us. For them, war on rebellion was messy and slow, like eating soup with a knife. And I read that phrase and instantly knew that I had the title of my dissertation. It was truly a eureka moment for me. I happened to be in the bathtub when I was reading Seven Pillars of Wisdom, as one does at Oxford. I was reading in the bathtub in 1995 or so, the middle of the Army's lost decade. So after the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the defeat of the Iraqi Army in Desert Storm, when the world was changing dramatically, the threats the United States faced were changing from state threats to irregular warfare threats. But the Army just kept on preparing to fight other conventional armies. And it did so, I think, in large consequence as a result of the long Vietnam hangover. After Vietnam, the Army was so burned by the experience of losing a counterinsurgency campaign that it decided it was never going to fight that kind of war again. Colin Powell, the great chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, lent his name along with Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, to the Powell-Weinberger Doctrine, which was a set of rules governing when the United States would intervene, which essentially precluded us from ever fighting a Vietnam kind of counterinsurgency campaign again. And so when insurgency and terrorism erupted as the primary threat to the United States, starting, I would argue, it should have been evident to us as early as 1993 with the first bombing of the World Trade Center, certainly should have been evident to us in 2000 with the attack on the USS Cole. Asymmetric warfare was rearing its ugly head, but we continued preparing to fight other armies despite the fact that there was no conceivable way any of those armies would choose to fight us that way.
And as a researcher now, a scholar doing a dissertation at Oxford, your progress in that research uncovers these wow moments where you discover there are certain texts that were written by the French, the British, and even some analysis in the U.S., but all of it really suppressed in the learning process of soldiers in the various academies and in the training schools.
Nothing I write is original. Like my title, which I stole from T.E. Lawrence, my ideas about counterinsurgency are stolen from authors like David Galula, Sir Robert Thompson. And almost all of the good writing on counterinsurgency comes from soldiers who have practiced it, have lived the bitter grind that is a counterinsurgency campaign, who understand that what armies want to do, charge gloriously across a field of open battle in the sunshine with the cannons in the background and the cavalry guidon snapping in the breeze, that is not the real business of the vast majority of soldiering. Most of it is what Rudyard Kipling called the savage wars of peace, small wars on the fringes of empire against enemies who won't fight us conventionally, who fight us as assassins and guerrillas. And this is something that Americans ought to understand, because this is how we became a country. We fought the Redcoats, the British Empire, the greatest power in the world, and we fought them as terrorists and insurgents, and we did not fight according to the rules of warfare conventionally accepted at the time. And the Brits complained that they were fighting against an uncivilized tribe that didn't follow the rules of warfare, and we said, "You're right, but we won." So we have no excuse for not knowing how to fight these kind of wars. Galula told us how to do it. Robert Thompson taught us how to do it. Edward Lansdale, an American, taught us how to do it. A Bright Shining Lie, Neil Sheehan's wonderful book about the great American counterinsurgent in Vietnam. The literature was there. The evidence was there that these were the kind of wars we were going to fight, but they weren't the kind of wars we wanted to fight. And so we studiously focused on what we wanted to do, not on what was actually there in front of us.
And as a scholar, you finish your dissertation, and You had trouble finding a publisher, as I understand.
I literally couldn't get Soup published. I got rejection letters for in the late 1990s from very good university presses asking me why I was studying a subject that had no relevance to modern national security affairs, and asking me why I didn't study something with contemporary relevance. And that didn't change until after the attacks of September 11th made it clear that insurgency and terrorism were back with a vengeance.
And so you finally found a Prager as a publisher, but it was a limited circulation book and so on. So
just this side of a vanity press.
Yeah. So it then begins your long odyssey to take an idea which you've worked through in your dissertation, drawing on these other sources, and change actually the Army's thinking about the war. So what was that? I mean, that took a lot of guts, right? I mean, or was it that you really believed it and you were committed to being a good soldier and you had been to war and had a sense of what might be coming?
So I certainly had a sense of what might be coming. And again, the good news is I was right and the bad news is I was right. I have to go back a little bit further to my decision to go back to Oxford to write the book that became Soup. And I just commanded a cavalry troop in Germany and done reasonably well at it. And the Army wanted me to either become the aide-de-camp to the commanding general of the 1st Infantry Division or to command a second, larger unit. And those would be the typical decisions made by an officer in my position who wanted to become a general. And I wanted to go back to Oxford to study counterinsurgency, to study warfare, and to earn my PhD. And I did so against the express, very explicit advice of my branch detailer, who told me that by doing so, I was taking myself out of contention for general officer stars. And I told him that if studying my profession and learning about my profession at one of the world's great universities meant that I was not qualified to be a senior leader in my profession, my profession had some problems, and I was willing to take that risk. So, for better or for worse, I've been pigheaded for a long time. But during my studies of insurgency and terrorism and counterinsurgency and observing what was going on around me with the World Trade Center bombing of 1993, with the Cole bombing, which happened while I was writing my master's thesis at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, on asymmetric threats to U.S. national security. I did that over the course of 2000. I finished in June 2001 with a paper called Hitting Us Where We Don't Expect It, Asymmetric Threats to U.S. National Security to the Year 2020, which argued that we weren't going to see this kind of enemy, but we were very, very certainly going to see this kind of enemy, and it was coming soon. And again, the good news is I was right, and the bad news is I was right. I was primed, I think, to experience the kind of war that I'd been predicting for a decade at that point firsthand.
And in this journey as a gadfly, can you identify one or two turning points in, I mean, you went back to Iraq once after the invasion, and so what you were doing in practice as a soldier confirmed your thinking.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So I thought counterinsurgency was going to be hard. I titled my book on it, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, which doesn't sound like a vacation. What I found out when I had to do it myself was that it was far, far harder than I'd ever imagined. And intellectually, I understood what I wanted to do, what I needed to do, but every step I wanted to take, I knew where I wanted to go, but it was as if I was in mud up to my neck. And every step of the way, people I couldn't see were setting off roadside bombs and firing at us as snipers and putting mines in the roads and assassinating the people we were working with to try to build a better Iraq. And so over the course of that incredibly difficult year, 2003-2004 in Al-Anbar, Iraq, we had 22 fine young men killed and 150 wounded and earned a Valorous Unit Award. And at the end of the year, We were no further toward building stability and peace in Iraq. Toward St. Augustine said the only purpose of a war is to build a better peace. And boy, were we not building a better peace in Iraq, despite the extraordinary efforts and the extraordinary losses we had suffered. And so I came away from that bitter, bitter year of learning in Iraq, the most important year of my life, absolutely convinced that we were going to lose and shattered by the losses we'd suffered and by the young men whose faces I still see when I'm falling asleep, and absolutely determined to try to use my education and my experience to help us do better.
So in a way, the empathy skills that your mother taught you and your identification, your empathy for your fellow soldiers who were being screwed, in essence, by the doctrine that was guiding the combat. You go back to Washington, and your emotions as you try to change the system. I mean, talk a little about that, because it must have been very frustrating to realize that the top commanders, the political leaders in Washington, didn't get what was going on.
Had no idea. And so one hopes when you're out on point for the nation, when your friends are getting killed and horribly wounded, and you're eating sand, you're walking through mud up to your neck, all metaphors. We were literally eating sand. You hope that someone somewhere has a plan and that this is all part, the part you're seeing doesn't make sense, but it's all part of a broader plan that does make sense when you get far enough away and can see the whole thing in perspective. And it was unbelievably discouraging to return to a Pentagon where the word insurgency was not allowed to be used.
By Rumsfeld.
By the Secretary of Defense himself, forbid the use of the word insurgency to describe the insurgency in Iraq. If you don't admit you're an alcoholic, you can't cure your alcoholism. And if you don't admit you're fighting an insurgency, you will never have a counterinsurgency strategy. And so we didn't. We were absolutely making choices that were making it less likely that we were going to succeed. And more of our sons and daughters were getting killed. And so I started trying to build a coalition of people who understood that what we were fighting was an insurgency, who understood that there are historical best practices to be used in trying to defeat an insurgency, and who believed that we could do better if we were given the chance.
For the benefit of our audience, could you give us a brief description of what is involved when you understand insurgency? I mean, what is your goal, and what do you see?
So an insurgency is an illegal attempt to overthrow a government or change its policies through the use of force. Counterinsurgency is then all the efforts of a state or a coalition, a state and its friends, to defeat an insurgency. And ultimately, when we wrote the counterinsurgency field manual, we said that there are six logical lines of operation, six broad themes in conducting a counterinsurgency. There is combat operations against the enemy when you can identify them. That's the hard part. They are fish swimming in the sea of the people, to use Mao's phrase. It's hard to figure out who they are. But you kill them when you can. You capture them when you can. There is building host nation security forces who are ultimately going to take over the fight for you, building the Iraqi and Afghan armed forces. There is providing good governance to the people, giving them essential services, providing them with economic opportunity, and most of all, conducting effective information operations to change the minds of the people, to convince them that they have a better future if they throw their hand in with the government and its allies, with the counterinsurgent forces, than if they do that with the insurgents. And they can only make that decision if they believe that they are going to be safe and protected. And so one of the real pillars of counterinsurgency strategy is very different from conventional military strategy. So conventional military strategy says you focus on the enemy, you kill or capture the enemy, and you win the war. Counterinsurgency strategy believes that you have to kill and capture the enemy, but understands that to do that effectively, first you have to protect the populace. A very, very different, in my eyes, far more complicated task.
And I'm reminded of what Speaker O'Neill said about all politics is local. In a way, you're suggesting that all counterinsurgency is local.
All counterinsurgency is local, and so succeeding in it requires a very granular understanding of language and culture and politics inside each individual town. and developing those language skills and that cultural understanding at that granular level was a task of many years. And we still have not, as a nation, developed the language specialists, the culture specialists, the people who understand the politics, the tribal politics of Iraq and Afghanistan, of Saudi Arabia, of Yemen, to the extent that we desperately need. And my last job as Minerva Chair at the U.S. Naval Academy, this was my focus, this was my goal, to increase an appreciation for how important that cultural understanding is for success in modern war.
So now you're back in the United States, and on the one hand, the public generally is seeing the disaster that Iraq is becoming as we're losing the war. And you, upon your return, wind up, because I think what's really important here is this set of ideas was drawing strength from not only officers who had served in Vietnam and were who had served in Iraq and were learning, but also from people in the United States, in the military, intellectuals who were seeing that this was the wrong course. And so over the next couple of years, these people come to know each other, they're attending conferences together, and they are essentially coming up with a set of ideas similar to yours. And talk a little about that, because there was an intellectual ferment occurring, which is not to be expected from the army that you're describing, but which was occurring by individuals seeing what was going wrong.
Absolutely right. And we actually called ourselves an insurgency. We viewed ourselves as rebels against the system and consciously used the techniques of insurgency to try to defeat our own army and get it to change its way of thinking. And interestingly, these people, some of the most important, were Army officers who taught in the Social Sciences Department of West Point, David Petraeus, who had written his doctoral dissertation on Vietnam and the American public reaction to Vietnam. Conrad Crane, who had earned his PhD just down the road at Stanford, a historian, also taught at West Point, also wrote on Vietnam. I was the sort of junior member of the team, doctoral dissertation on Vietnam, recent combat experience in Al Anbar, and we found others like us. General James Mattis, last year's Nimitz lecturer, a phenomenal commander, my commander, commander of the 1st Marine Division in Al Anbar in 2004, now in charge of thinking for the Marine Corps' Combat Development Command. His designated thinker, external brain pack, Frank Hoffman, a Marine with a really smart Marine who understood irregular warfare, who really coined the term hybrid warfare. And so this group of half a dozen or so of us came together and were absolutely determined, even as the war was being lost and being lost rapidly, that we needed to do something different and help our Army not lose its second consecutive counterinsurgency campaign.
And Fortuna intervenes to a certain extent, in the sense that Petraeus is sent to Leavenworth to develop a new manual for combat.
The story is a little more complicated, and the long hand of the Social Sciences Department at West Point continues. So Mike Meese was the head of the Social Sciences Department at this time, an advisor to the Secretary of the Army, and Dave Petraeus was by no means Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld's favorite, and Rumsfeld was going to send Petraeus to be the superintendent at West Point, a position for which Petraeus was very well qualified, but something that would have taken him completely out of the wars. And Mike Meese intervened through Secretary of the Army and said, why don't we send him to Leavenworth instead? Leavenworth is even farther away from anything that matters than West Point is. He won't be able to do any damage out there. And of course, Mike Meese, one of the insurgents, knew that with Petraeus, if you're going to change the Army, Fort Leavenworth, command of Fort Leavenworth is the place from which you can do it. And Petraeus was not sent to Leavenworth to write a new counterinsurgency manual. Far from it. We still weren't allowed to use the word insurgency or counterinsurgency. But when his appointment to Leavenworth was announced, I recognized the opportunity and pulled him aside and said the first thing he needed to do and the most important thing he needed to do was write a new counterinsurgency manual. He rather dryly said that the thought had crossed his mind too, patted me on the head a little bit, but said, since you bring it up, get to work, Noggle. And so it wasn't just good fortune. There were machinations afoot. Interestingly, Secretary Rumsfeld heard rumors that Petraeus was writing a new counterinsurgency manual. He described it as a new strategy for Iraq. He sent one of his famous snowflakes, and the Army wrote back and said, nothing to see here, boss. These aren't the droids you're looking for. This is just normal updating of Army manuals. Nothing. Right. Don't.
So normal, a manual generally takes about 5 years to get written, but you got...
We turned this one in 13 months. We turned the first draft of it in 6 weeks over the Christmas holidays 2005 into 2006, and we held a vetting conference of this draft. So we started in November of 2005. In February of 2006, we held a vetting conference at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, that was a whole new thing for the Army. There were 100 people in the room. The session was co-chaired by Petraeus and by Sarah Sewell, a professor of human rights at the Carr Center at Harvard University, a Rhodes Scholar, a friend of mine, now a remarkable woman, Undersecretary of State, working for John Kerry. And so you've got a peacenik and a three-star Army general, infantryman, sitting next to each other, vetting an Army field manual, Army Marine Corps field manual, in front of an audience of 100 that includes Jim Fallows of the Atlantic Monthly, Greg Jaffe of the Washington Post. He may have still been at the Wall Street Journal then, but some of the best defense policy writers.
Yeah.
George Packer from the New Yorker, author of the great book, The Assassin's Gate. And so some of the most thoughtful defense policy writers were in the room on a straight background basis. And Petraeus knew, right, he was seeding these intellectual ideas into the people who were going to popularize them to the American public after this doctrine was published. Less than a year after that conference. So the conference in February of 2006, manual published December 15th, 2006.
And then we move to Washington, and really there's a coup against Secretary Rumsfeld. Not a coup. There is an election.
Coup is too strong. There was a coup shaping up. There was an extraordinary, the so-called revolt of the generals. So a number of retired generals over the course of 2006, bitter, as I was at the course of the Iraq War, convinced that Secretary Rumsfeld was not helping, started to foment an insurgency, an insurrection. It never rose to the level of coup. Them's fighting words. But there was certainly pressure on Secretary Rumsfeld. But the real driver of change was the midterm elections of 2006. And so the American people, God bless them, figured it out and demanded change, right, through both houses out. And both the House of Representatives and the Senate flipped from Republican to Democratic control. A very clear message to President George W. Bush that he needed to make some changes and needed to make them now.
And he did. He appoints Gates as Secretary of Defense, and then in turn Petraeus is named commander in Iraq. And I think we all know the general history, the Anbar Awakening, the implementation, a lot of the counterinsurgency ideas, and a surge which enables us to be in a better position to complete the mission, or think we're completing the mission in Iraq. In your lecture, so we won't go into the detail there because of the limits
of time. That story has been told.
Yeah. So what interests me is something you said in the lecture, which is we're getting counterinsurgency right, but it's not clear that we've yet gotten the politics, the national politics, right. And it's very important in terms of this military doctrine for there be an interface between with the political leadership. And you said something. You said that President George W. Bush got the intervention wrong.
Badly wrong.
Badly wrong.
Badly wrong. Yeah. Worst mistake, very likely the worst mistake in American foreign policy history. A disaster, a fiasco, an unnecessary war, poorly conducted.
And then you said that President Obama got the leaving wrong. Talk a little about that, because that brings us to the present situation.
The primary mistakes were George W. Bush's and a disaster of a war, which is putting on the credit card of the American people. So the first war in history where we haven't had a draft, and I'm not recommending a draft by no means. We don't need one, the all-volunteer force succeeding beyond our wildest dreams, but also the first war in history for which we haven't had a tax increase. And so the entire $4 trillion cost of our generation's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is being passed on to our sons and daughters, and I think that's appalling. And that's a national policy mistake. The saving grace for George W. Bush is in 2006 when he replaced his Secretary of Defense, his commander on the field, surged American troops, changed strategy, and created out of a fiasco of a war, an embarrassment of a war, a disaster for American national security objectives, a huge strengthening, the creation of al-Qaeda in Iraq. The policies of Gates and the strategy of Petraeus, implemented by Petraeus and his team on the ground, the Anbar Awakening, the SAWA, a 75% decrease in violence over Petraeus's 18 months in command, got us to a point where there was a more than reasonable chance of a reasonably democratic Iraq, a reasonably stable Iraq, that with the long-term security guarantee of perhaps 15 or 20,000 American troops could have been a pillar of American foreign policy in a very difficult, very dangerous part of the world. And all President Obama needed to do to make that happen was keep 20,000 American troops, largely advisors, some special forces, some air power, stationed in Iraq for a generation. And he chose, against the advice of his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, his Secretary of Defense, the remarkable aforementioned Bob Gates, best Secretary of Defense we've ever had, his Director of Central Intelligence, Leon Panetta, no slouch, his Central Command Commander at this time, David Petraeus, every national security professional on the planet said, leave 20,000 American troops in Iraq. And in December of 2011, the President Obama chose to pull all the American troops out of Iraq. Disaster was widely foretold, including by me, but by many smarter people than me. And sure as shooting, disaster resulted with the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And over the course of the last 18 months, its capture of the western third of Iraq, a territory that exceeds the United Kingdom in size, giving it the biggest geographic base any terror organization has had in the history of man.
So the non-intervention agenda, which was driven in part by the dissatisfaction of the public now with the Iraq war, the concern about losing the war, was in a way led to an overreaction where we set a date, we pull everything out. So it's like incompletion of the stabilization operation. Is that what you're saying?
So I'm absolutely right. So when America fights a war, when a situation in the world is important enough to spill the blood of America's sons and daughters on that ground, it is important enough then to leave American troops there for generations to come to keep whatever caused that war from happening from breaking out again. And this is the policy we followed for the last 75 years. We still have American troops in Germany, Italy, and Japan 75 years after the Second World War. American troops in South Korea 65 years after that war. The former Yugoslavia 25 years after that war. And we don't have them in Vietnam because we lost that one. But ironically, the Vietnamese would love us to home port a carrier in Cameron Bay. So the real purpose of the American Army is not so much to win wars as having won wars to stay there and keep the next war from breaking out. And we had every opportunity to do that in Iraq. We failed to do so, and predictably horrific consequences
and
resulted.
And we're maybe failing to do that in Afghanistan.
So literally today as we speak, there are news accounts that the commander of American forces in Afghanistan, in conjunction with the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, are making noises that I hope have been cleared with the administration, because it means that the administration is going to cave and is going to leave a long-term American security presence in Afghanistan. And if we don't, if we fail to heed the lessons of the past 4 years in Iraq, I will personally guarantee that 3 years after the departure of the last American troops from Afghanistan, the Taliban will be back at the gates of Kabul, and we will have to re-intervene in Afghanistan. We'll have to fight another war in Afghanistan, just as we are unnecessarily having to fight another war in Iraq, because we didn't stick the landing, we failed to build a better peace, we didn't leave that long-term presence of American troops to secure what we'd fought for and won.
Now, your last assignment in the Army was attempting to train a corps of military advisors who would be inserted in the stability operation, inserted in the forces of the ruling government. Talk a little about that and what the idea is.
So I mentioned the six logical lines of operation and counterinsurgency campaign. The second one is train and advise and equip host nation security forces. So in a counterinsurgency campaign, you're not going to kill or capture all of the insurgents. They're still going to be there. Some of their root grievances are likely to endure for generations. These wars have long tails. T. Lawrence said they're messy and slow. So we don't want to stay there forever ourselves in large numbers as the combat forces. We want their troops to do that. However, we can make them far, far more effective with small teams of American advisors. And this is the Special Forces A-team model, but we need a whole lot more of them than we have A-teams available. Teams of a dozen or so American soldiers who provide access to intelligence that the host nation simply isn't going to have, access to air power and control of air power, access to logistics assets, including medical support. All of these are combat multipliers so that an Iraqi battalion or an Afghan battalion with a 12-man American team embedded inside it is three or four or five times more effective in combat than that same battalion is without the American advice and support. And so for pennies on the dollar, for a very small number of American troops, we can dramatically increase the effectiveness of these forces and make them more politically reliable for the government of Afghanistan or Iraq and more capable counterterrorism forces as well.
I am reminded, listening to your lecture and listening to you here, of something that President Kennedy said in one of his last interviews, and it was, in the final analysis, he was talking about Vietnam, this is their war. And I think you understand that. But what I'm do you have any thoughts about how you navigate the limited stabilization operation that you just described? How you limit that so it then doesn't become a massive intervention?
The way you achieve that objective is by keeping the American troops on the ground for a generation, mm-hmm. and the creation and extraordinary success of the all-volunteer force gives the President of the United States, gives our foreign policy mechanism, the tools we need to do that effectively. So there is no groundswell of public anger. There is no demand from the American people for a full American withdrawal from Iraq or from Afghanistan. The American people, I'm confident, don't know that we still have troops in the former Yugoslavia. And that's success in these kinds of wars is pulling the news off of the front pages and to the back pages and then completely out of the newspaper. And I see the existence of the all-volunteer force, the success of the all-volunteer force, as a tool that will enable the United States to maintain stability and security in Afghanistan for generations, and by the way, maintain special forces bases inside Afghanistan and intelligence gathering stations inside Afghanistan, which will allow us to keep an eye on Afghanistan's next door neighbor to the east, the most dangerous state in the world for America. I see 20,000 American troops in Iraq, not just stabilizing Iraq, not just preventing the Islamic State from seizing territory from which to plan and conduct and execute attacks on us and our friends, but also as a stabilizing basis and a special forces series of bases to enable us to conduct operations when necessary against radical Islamists throughout the Middle East. So there are huge benefits for the relatively small investment in treasure, and as time goes by, the remarkably small investment in blood that will be required of these combat advisors and special forces teams that I believe we need to station for the long haul in Iraq and Afghanistan.
One final question. Your theory in a lot of your work is about creating learning organizations, especially in the military. Talk briefly about the United States as a learning organization. In other words, what is the job of our political leaders in helping the public learn the kinds of things that you've been articulating?
I think we have our political leaders have a very significant role in doing that, and I give them a decidedly mixed review in how well they've done that. Certainly, the invasion of Iraq was unnecessary in 2003. The attacks of September 11th, in some ways predictable. The Richard Clark, the National Security Council Director for Counterterrorism, said the dials were glowing red during the summer of 2001. We did do a good job of evaluating our mistakes in the 9/11 Commission report. And that was a very honest and open assessment of our failures. We have not had at the national level the same sort of assessment of our failures in Iraq and in Afghanistan. There have been a number of remarkably good books by journalists that have done so, and I'm thinking of Tom Ricks's Fiasco, George Packer's The Assassin's Gate are two of the books that do a wonderful job of laying out the extraordinary mistakes we made. I have to give George W. Bush credit. During his speech after the midterms of 2006, in early 2007, when he announced the surge of American troops into Iraq to practice a new counterinsurgency strategy under the command of a new commander, David Petraeus, George W. Bush admitted mistakes and admitted failings and did so honestly and painfully and demonstrated, I think, a remarkable degree of learning during his tenure as president that serves him well and that is an example for future presidents. What I am discouraged by is that this president, President Obama, who has not made nearly as grievous of errors as did his predecessor, with mistakes like failing to intervene to prevent the attacks of September 11th unnecessarily and poorly invading Iraq in 2003, the first three horribly mismanaged years of that war. President Obama has made smaller mistakes, but still very significant mistakes, and has not yet demonstrated an ability to admit those mistakes or to learn from them. And we are only now in March of 2015 starting to see some indications that he understands that the premature withdrawal of American troops from Iraq, which enabled and empowered the return of ISIS and the creation of this horrible terror threat to the whole world, was a mistake. And perhaps now a willingness to at least implicitly admit that mistake and change American policy in Afghanistan so that we don't provide a home base for his radical Islamic extremists there. If there is one basic principle of American counterterrorism strategy since September 11th, it has been do not give our enemies a geographic base in which to plan, prepare for, from which to conduct attacks on us and our friends. We failed that test in Iraq, and it's going to take the lives of my friends and a whole lot of American treasure and a whole lot of Iraqi soldiers and civilians dying unnecessarily to undo that mistake. God have mercy on us if we make the same mistake again in Afghanistan.
Well, Dr. Nagel, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us and discuss your really great books, which I will recommend, especially the new one, to our audience, Knife Fights. And thank you again. It was really an intellectual odyssey for our audience, not as complicated as the one that you took, but I think really helpful for public education. Thank you.
It's an honor to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.